You recall, brethren and sisters, that last night we were dealing with the element of note-taking before we brought the class to a close. How many of you remember the key word that I tried to pass on to you? What was it? It was a single word starting with C. Consistency. If you wanted to use a big piece of paper, make sure everything was on a big piece of paper. If you're going to use a 3.5 by 5 card, make sure everything is on a 3.5 by 5 card. When you accumulate data over a period of time, it is almost essential that you have a consistent mode of doing it. That's where we left off before we got into the questions. We were dealing with the selection of subject matter and the importance of the necessity to be very careful that you don't overextend yourself. We saw a good example just a few moments ago. I don't know how many of you timed that brother. Did any of you time him? How long was that talk?
30 minutes.
30 minutes right on the button. Now, I don't know that Brother Charles designed it that way, but I suspect that he knew his own internal discipline in terms of what he intended to cover in that subject. I have heard a whole series of Bible school studies on the book of Esther, fitting into six nice components. An entirely different approach than you heard tonight. Point being, don't ever overload yourself, and this is being redundant, but when you select a subject to deal with in an exhortation or lecture, make doubly sure that you're able to cover your material. That's one of the reasons why you have got to look at a major database and select from that only that which is appropriate to the time frame, the occasion, and your own responsibility. We can't say that too often, brethren. Now, once you have determined your subject, you will work most effectively in accumulating and digesting your material if you adopt this general principle. Now, what is that general principle? You must begin your preparation early. None of this last-minute business unless it's an emergency. Begin your preparation early. This is both good moral advice, brethren, but it's also sound psychology. In other words, it's a good rule to start preparing early, but it's also sound psychology. You know, it's a fundamental, an absolute fundamental element to the way human minds work. And each one of you have a human mind, whatever our capacities and our limitations might be. Ideas and information, without exception, ideas and information have to cook and stew a little bit in our minds. They've got to cook and stew a little bit. They've got to mix around in our minds for a reasonable period of time before they're really ready for use. You know, when you've selected a subject, set your mind to work on it. That starts the stewing process. Set your mind to work on it. You'd be surprised if you just sit down. I close my eyes. You don't have to close your eyes. You can look at a blank wall if you want to. And let that mind begin to go in this avenue or that avenue to address this facet. And it's just like somebody dropping a pebble in a pool. You all know what I'm going to say. The rings begin to go out. Before long, you've got more things cooking and stewing than you can really reduce to hard copy. Remember two nights ago when I said the first thing you want to do is to think about what you already know before you begin to dig into additional material? It's an excellent starting point, and it's the place where that element of cooking and stewing takes place when you have selected your subject material. Now, let's address a few elements in how we make an exhortation, a class, or a lecture clear. I'm going to get into mechanics before we're through tonight, but now we're talking about how we go about, in a mindset, making an exhortation, a class, or a lecture clear. I mean, after all, we're dead in the water if we don't make it clear. That's a truism that we can all accept. First of all, it's got to be clear in our own mind. We cannot be fuzzy about our subject matter. We've got to have a clear idea in our own mind before we try in any way, shape, or form to reduce it and then transmit it to an audience. That's point one that you've got to understand. You've got to clarify things in your own mind first. Then we must make sure that we can translate what we mean as speakers into a way that your audience will understand. In other words, I know, or at least I suspect, what my limitations and capacities are. If I sit down and think about something that is clear to me, and I can be satisfied in myself, that's only half of the battle. The next thing I've got to do, once I've got it clear in my own mind, is say, now, wait a minute. How do I go about translating what is clear to me to my audience so that they will understand it, particularly in view of the fact that you have a dichotomy sitting out there? We've got a dichotomy here tonight. The whole spectrum is generally represented, whether it's a broad spectrum or a narrow spectrum, the whole spectrum is generally represented in your audience in terms of a Sunday morning exhortation and certainly in a public lecture, not to mention the series of classes like we're having this week. Therefore, you've got to seriously consider, don't ignore it. Think about it. How do I make the best of my ability that I understand to translate to the audience that I've got in front of me so that I think they will understand? Now, that might mean, brethren, and this is nothing to apologize for, that might mean that you will have to be rather simple and direct for a portion of your audience, and those in the audience that might be, well, might tend to say, gee, that was too simple or too direct, they're going to have to sit there and take that in a respectful way, because what you're doing is treating the whole audience. Now, that's a difficult thing to do. But if you are aware of it, again, in your mindset, to the extent that's feasible within a time frame, you bring that into consideration. Sometimes it's even appropriate. If you happen to have, and I've done this myself, and it's rather effective. I've been told it's effective, and that's the only playback you can get. When I have had young people sitting in an audience in an exhortation mode, I will sometimes take 2 minutes to step aside from the podium and address those young people who are not even immersed. I will let them know that the point that my brothers and sisters are getting from me is something I want you young people to understand. And here's the way I will explain it to you. You'd be surprised those youngsters stand up. Some of them literally stand up. I got one of them in my eye contact one morning, and he got up and stood there, and his antenna went up. Well, you know, it kind of embarrassed me, but I grabbed him. You see the point I'm driving? Now, you don't want to make a practice of doing that for the sake of doing it. All I'm trying to tell you at this stage of the game is when you are clear in your own mind, you think about how you make those ideas and information, scripturally or otherwise, clear to the dichotomy that exists in your audience. Very, very important. Now, one of the best ways of doing this, a general shotgun approach, and that's used in the best sense of the word, is to use definitions. If there's any question in your mind that there might be one or more individuals in your audience that might not be getting what you have clear in your mind. Now, a lot of us do this by second nature, but I'm going to tell you in simple terms what I'm talking about. One of the best ways to make sure that the maximum number in your audience understands what you're saying is to use synonyms. If there's any question in your mind that they don't understand a word, I used a word a moment ago on purpose. I'm going to ask you honestly, how many of you know what the word dichotomy means? One, two, three. possibly 3.5. That was no put down. So what's the definition of the word dichotomy? I can give it to you by a synonym. It means opposite understandings, opposite positions, different, different. Now all of a sudden you know basically what that means. If there's any question in your mind as a speaker that you're using a term or addressing a concept that some in your audience, and possibly all of them, don't understand, don't hesitate to use the technique of using synonymous terms. One of the well-used English words is aversion. Well, what's an automatic synonym for the word aversion? Is dislike. I have an aversion, Clarence. That means I dislike it. That's a simple example of what I'm talking about. Another very effective way is to classify. To classify. Now, what do I mean by that? Man is a rational animal. Now, what have I just told you? That man's an animal. He's been classified as an animal, but he's a rational animal, which means that the only difference between man and other animals is that God has bestowed upon him the capability of thinking, emotions, a mind, what have you. But I've classified man as an animal, rational though he may be. Now, there are many examples of that, but that's a type of thing that tends to lift your hearing audience to a higher understanding of what you're talking about. And you know something? That kind of classification can be amplified very effectively in terms of Jesus Christ. Very important in a public lecture, I would suggest, brethren, particularly when you have people out there who think that Jesus Christ is one-third of a triune, co-equal, co-eternal God. When you begin to talk about the classification of man, mortal man, then you can go into that situation. I don't want to belabor it, but I think you get my point. Another element, the etymology of words. Now here again, I'm using a word that I'm going to have to define for you. But it's a very effective way. Our brethren have been doing it all week long. Etymology simply means going back to the original meaning of a word. The origin of that word. Etymology of the word. The etymology of the word definition, for example, itself means being limited. In other words, when you define, you are limiting. So when you go back to the etymology of words, and we do that with the Hebrew and Greek all the time in the truth, don't we? It's a very effective element. Don't hesitate to use it. You don't want to overuse it, obviously, but it's one more way that a speaker can and does transmit to his audience what he already has clear in his mind. I know what the word Rabshakeh means. How many of you know what the word Rabshakeh means? Well, I'm sure some of you do if you think about it. Remember the exchange between Sennacherib, Hezekiah, the Rabshakeh? Well, you go back to the etymology of that word and you find out that that fella was the general of the army. And that's what that word means, and yet the word Rabshakeh is what shows up in our Bible. Now, if you explain that, just as an example, explain that in terms of an exhortation or a lecture, you've clarified in the minds of your audience what you're talking about. How many of you have read over and over again the term the host, H-O-S-T, in the Authorized Version? How many of you know what the etymology of that word is? Some of you probably do. But particularly in a class or a lecture, and sometimes in an exhortation, it's important. It simply means army. You go back to the etymology of that word, it means army. The army of God. You understand what I mean by use of the term etymology. These things tend to translate what you have clear in your mind to the point that your audience understands more effectively. Use examples. Visual aids sometimes can be used, particularly in public lectures. I would not recommend them in exhortations, except in rare instances. And brethren, there is absolutely nothing wrong with repetition and restatement, unless you get yourself into a circuitous treatment for the sake of filling time. Never do that. But the repetition and restatement of a specific point can be very effectively used to make sure your audience understands what you're saying. Question? Just scratching your ear. Fine. Now, when we outline a talk, I don't care whether you script it or note it. There's a cardinal basic rule, brethren, and it's this. Do not ramble. You open your talk with an introduction. You develop what you want to say. You conclude it, and you sit down. We had a dear brother for many, many years in our ecclesia who was very good expounding the scriptures, exhorting his brothers and sisters, but there's one thing he could never do. He did not know how to finish a talk. He could not stop. Try as he may, he never could conclude it, and it used to trouble him. Finally, we took him aside and gave him several structures that enabled him to do it. And he finally learned after some 40 years. Excuse me. Rambling is a disastrous thing to do. You've got to learn to stop. Now, when you introduce a talk, you'd better get the audience's attention right away. Well, there are many ways of doing that. I'm not going to go through those now. But when you introduce a talk, get the audience's attention. You should always orient your audience, usually our ecclesia, obviously, to the purpose of what you're going to say. In terms of getting attention, you can always take advantage of the physical stimuli that you are in control of. Facial, body movement, a scowl or a smile or a little quirk out of the head. You'd be surprised how effective that is. You know, I saw Arnie raise the eyebrow. Now, if those in the Detroit Ecclesia or the Largo Ecclesia anticipate that raised eyebrow, he's got their attention right off the bat. Now, that's a very shallow thing that I'm saying. But I want you to I'm illustrating the point that your own bodily movement, as well as the way you look, can get one's attention. Look them right in the eye. Remember what I said last night? When you step up to the platform, it was last night or the night before, I'm not sure which. Get yourself comfortable. Look your audience right in the eye before you open your mouth. I've seen a very effective brother stand for 30 seconds and stare at the audience. It almost got uncomfortable. I mean, the people began to squirm a little bit. What's he going to do? Well, that's overdoing it a little bit. But it's the use of a very effective technique. You don't stand up there as a general rule and start before you even get to the platform running it out. Get yourself relaxed. Look them right in the eye. And then move out. Then move out. You've got their attention. Very important. If you don't grasp the attention of your hearer at the outset, it's highly unlikely that you're ever going to get it during the discourse, whether it's an exhortation or a lecture. It's always good, if you can, brethren, to stimulate the curiosity or the imagery in the minds of your hearers. Remember, I said that the human mind is something that psychologically is always working. It's cooking and stewing. Brother Harry, in one of his classes the other day, said, I always envision this situation this way. I forget the subject matter, but remember he said somebody was coming from this direction and over here. That's the way he imagined that. Well, orally, you can do that for your audience. You may not change the picture in their minds, but don't ever think it's bad to draw a mental picture for your audience. I remember some years ago, a brother, Alan Hayward, was giving a talk at, I guess it was Alton Jones. And brother Eugene Turner, who's an emotional person anyhow, was sitting beside me up near the front. And Alan gave such a vivid description of the crucifixion of Christ. Maybe one of you were there. Remember the spike that he brought up? Out of nowhere, a spike that long. He'd already drawn the picture in our minds in very vivid language. And he brought that spike up. And the minute he brought that spike up, Brother Turner broke into tears. Well, I wasn't very far behind him, I'll tell you. It was a beautiful example of transmitting imagery, a mental picture, to the audience. A very good technique, very good technique. Don't hesitate to use it if you can draw those kinds of pictures. At the outset, it's very important quite often to refer to the significance of your subject. Put it into context of how significant it is in terms of the time or occasion. Bring them up short right away. I'm not just here to fill time. The reason I'm talking to you about this is because A, B, and C. And when you get to the conclusion, brethren, don't ramble. You can conclude by restating your subject message right up front. In other words, the first sentence or two of your thought process, restating it. In other words, you put it up there in front, you've developed it, now you're bringing it to a conclusion by restating it. Or you can summarize quickly. I don't mean a summary that runs 7 to 10 minutes. I mean a summary that's no more than 2 to 2.5 minutes long. Very effective ways to conclude. If, in fact, the development of your talk is such that you have gotten to the point where you needn't conclude it, you have said everything. Sit down. Sometimes that's the most effective conclusion you can possibly have. Stop and sit. Various and sundry ways. Point being, however, don't ramble. When you come to the point to conclude, conclude. Now, how about the in-between, the transition in the body of a talk? It's important for your own help and the understanding of chronological treatment in your audience's mind to use signposts along the way. First of all, we'll deal with this. Secondly, this. Thirdly, this. 1, 2, 3, or A, B, C. I don't mean to say first, second, and third necessarily, or A, B, C necessarily, but the point is, in an orderly development of a subject matter, your transition from one area to another can very well use those kinds of terms. For example, in the first place, brethren, let's address this morning. A couple minutes later. Now, secondly, I'd like to bring to your attention. In the third place, we might consider this. And finally, let's look at this. You see what I've done? Now, maybe I've covered 20 or 25 minutes. But I've used very effective, chronological, in the minds of your hearers, chronological stepping stones. They are with you all the way. There's no proposition in their mind as, well, how long is he going to go on? What's he trying to say? How do these things relate one to another? Very effective techniques. Don't hesitate to use them. Another technique that's usable is flashback and preview. You may have spent 5 minutes dealing with a specific study. And then you come to the second unit and you say, now I have just referred to, and you can summarize that in one sentence. Now what you've done is to transit, if I may use that term, from what you've just said with the use of a flashback. And then you preview what you're going to say in another sentence. That's a little more complicated than firstly, secondly, and thirdly. But here again, the nature of what you're dealing with will dictate how you might use these Brethren, what I'm talking about is the kinds of things you think about when you are preparing to speak. Your own mindset to make you more effective. In keeping, yes.
There's one brother that spoke. He said that 6 kilos of faith that we'll talk about this morning. Mm-hmm. You get 30 minutes talk. Mm-hmm. 20 minutes went by. He's only spoke for two.
Serious mistake.
Now he finished up in a hurry, but then in your own mind you say, "Boy, he's got 10 minutes that he's going to be an hour."
That's right. Now, if in fact we have a brother who's very good at this, if in fact he's going to deal with the six and take 20 minutes on the first two, the beginning he says, "There's 6 points that I'd like to deal with." The first two, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on than the last four. You see, he's taking care of that just like that. Question?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly no longer than the preceding stages. Now, that's not a cop-out, Brother Reuben. The point is, you never want to, in your final stage, spend more time than the stages 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, whatever the case may be. Because you've done then what Brother Harry's talking about. You've lost your audience. They've begun to say, how long is he going to go on? Instead of thinking about what you're saying, they're saying, how long is he going to go on? And that's not what you want them to think about, particularly in an exhortive sense. So the rule of thumb is, obviously, no longer than any of the preceding ones. Preferably shorter. Yes? Well, we dealt with that last night. I'll repeat it. 25 to 35 minutes. Maximum 35, generally 25 to 30 minutes. There are exceptions to that, but that's a good rule because your idea is to make sure that the brothers and sisters get the exhortive points you want. And if you do anything that destroys that exhortive point, you've lost the ball game. And one of the quickest ways to do something to lose it is to have them start thinking the way Harry has mentioned. When's he going to finish? When's he going to finish? Because when they start thinking about that way, it's wiped out everything you've said ahead, or at least most of it. Now, in keeping your various ongoing points distinct, it's always wise, brethren, to adopt what we might call a consistent set of conjunctive adverbs. Now, what do I mean by that? A conjunctive adverb is moreover, also, furthermore, and finally. Ever use them? Ever use them? It's a good idea. A good idea to think about that. Whether you're in a note posture, and certainly when you're in a manuscript posture, and Brother Harry, we are going to get to the manuscript, all right? Now, some general thoughts in maintaining interest. Think of and use appropriate context, appealing first of all, and you can do this in the truth very effectively, first of all, context and appeal to one's well-being, to the uniqueness of the situation, to sentimental connections, to one's curiosity, and even one's droll sense of humor. Let me go over those again. Maintaining interest in terms of your exhortation, your class, or your public lecture should not divorce itself from appealing to the improvement of one's well-being, and that has all kinds of facets to it, to the uniqueness of the position of your audience, and that is certainly the case with those in the body of Christ, to satisfaction with the position illustrated. You've been baptized. You're in a covenant covering. What mercy God has bestowed upon us. How thankful we should be. In other words, we're appealing to the satisfaction of that element. quite legitimately, nothing wrong with that at all. Sentimental attachments. Sentimental attachments, yes. When we allude to the writings of our pioneers, that's what we're doing, quite legitimately. When we're alluding to the way we were brought up in the truth by our parents, the way we were taught the truth when we were outside of the truth and converted, are all sentimental attachments. But they're very telling. They're very telling. How many of you, for example, in this audience, have ever been disinterested in knowing how the brother or sister next to you was brought into the truth? None of you. And that's sentimental. Not maudlin, but sentimental. Quite proper. Curiosity, and very carefully handled, Brother Chuck, as you suggested the other night, humor. Now, speaking from manuscript. Speaking from manuscripts and other sources. First of all, let me make it very clear to you that I'm not suggesting for a moment that reading aloud is easy. It is not. It's not easy. The way one accomplishes it, accomplishes a degree of perfection in this, is to train and practice. I could spend the next hour dealing with this, but I'm not going to do that. I just laid my Bible open here. I don't know what, I'll tell you now, but I didn't know what it was open to. It happens to be John chapter 14, 15. I'm going to try something. I want you to watch it. These things I have spoken to you while I am still with you, but the Counselor, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all that I have said to you. Now, what two things did I just do that I shouldn't have done? Exactly. Exactly. Now, we'll try to do it differently. These things I have spoken to you while I am still with you. But the Counselor, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all that I have said to you. Now, I don't know whether I translated that with feeling or not. First time I've read that, I just picked it up and read it. But would any of you hazard a guess as to the percentage of time that I was looking at that two verses I just read, percentage-wise? Yeah. That's a pretty good percentage, Harry. Probably half. Hopefully not any more than half. Now, the way, if I were to practice that four or five times, that half would raise to 80%, or would rise to 80%. When you're dealing with a manuscript, and we're going to get into some specifics in a moment, or reading, practice, practice, practice. Every Sunday morning in our meeting, we always let the reader know what the speaking brother wants to have read, so that he has time at least once or twice to look that reading over. It pays dividends, real dividends. Of course, we have a range of capabilities there, but it pays real dividends. You try not to throw it at him blind. However, there is absolutely no excuse, none whatever, for an exhortive or lecturing brother not to effectively use a manuscript or effectively read, because he in his preparation has had time, or certainly should have taken time, to go over and over and over. Remember what we said the first night? Aloud, preferably in front of a mirror. If you want to use a tape recorder, that's fine too. So we are without excuse, brethren. Now let's talk about a manuscript for a moment. Because I know most brethren, and this is no put down at all, most brethren use manuscripts, either in total or in major part. when you are using a manuscript, by all means, and I purposely did this the first night, and some of you picked it up, by all means, type or write on one side of the paper only. Never get yourself in a situation where you do that. Never. My notes are that way on this purposely, and it was picked up the first night by a couple of brethren who mentioned it to me, and I said, fine, I'll mention it the last night. Always, I mean always, use one side of the paper. Preferably have it typed. If you have a wife or you yourself can type, you can buy a good typewriter now for less than $150. With word processors coming out, good typewriters are cheap. I just bought a new electric portable a year ago and paid $190 for it, and it does everything but cook my coffee. So if you use a manuscript, try to type it. And if you do type it, one side of the paper, at least double space, maybe even triple space. Because when you do that, it's going to give you a chance to do several things I'm going to mention in a moment. But in handling that manuscript, when you're reading it, instead of taking a piece of paper and folding it down like that, you can just slip it over. And nobody knows what you're doing. Nobody can see it. This lectern, of course, is not the kind we normally have in our halls. But even here, if I had a manuscript in front of me, typed on one side of the page, I could slip from one page to the other without you knowing it. And that is absolutely essential. One of the worst things, brethren, and this happens all the time, is to have a brother with a paper clip or a staple in this business, and he's reading from one page, and he turns it over like this. Horrible is the word for it. It should never happen. It is so easy not to have it happen. Malcolm. No, I would say don't use a notebook, Malcolm. I know brethren sometimes do, but here again, we're trying to honestly point out things that will improve. And the best way is to get away from that notebook where you fold the pages, which a lot of people do. Yes, Bob?
Do you recommend just having headings or notes?
Well, I haven't gotten to the notes yet, Bob. I'm talking about a manuscript right now. In the note situation, I'll address that. In the note situation, whatever's comfortable for you, whatever you understand in terms of looking at those notes is all you need, because your audience is never going to see those notes. Whatever will flash to your mind what you need to know in a chronological, orderly, systemic way is the way you do it. Whether it's headings, dots and dashes, underscoring, I use all of them, but it's what's comfortable for me, and that's what I would say to you. Use what's comfortable to you. Yes, sir. Yes. No, not at all. Not at all. It does when you flip the page. That's why I'm addressing that point. You want to avoid page flipping if you can. And there's no reason why you can't. That's what I'm trying to say right now, honestly and lovingly. There's nothing wrong with a brother having a manuscript. Nothing whatever. Nothing wrong with that at all. I'm simply saying when you do, there are unobtrusive ways of dealing with that which may interrupt the audience's concentration. The best way is to make sure it's double-spaced, even if you're writing it out in hand. Leave spaces there where you can have signposts, which I'll get to in a moment, and slip it aside. Never turn it over, and never do this. And if you can avoid a notebook, Malcolm, do it. Do it. Now, one of the major reasons, and this is a progressive thing, one of the major reasons for using double or triple space, single side of pages, is that this permits you, as a progressive learning process, to insert signposts. We had a brother not too long ago who gave his first exhortation in our meeting, and a brother with many, many years' experience, having just moved to our area and become a member of our meeting, was astounded that this was this brother's first exhortation. He couldn't believe it when I told him. But one of the things that made that brother's first exhortation so absolutely, not perfect, but so absolutely acceptable, was the fact that he had followed some of the things I'm talking about right now. and had used effectively this point. He had signposts. In fact, he showed them to me. He had signposts inserted at 5 different positions in his manuscript. And he had practiced that manuscript so that his eye contact, Harry, was at least 50%. But when he came to that signpost, he left his manuscript altogether. He knew exactly what he wanted to say when he hit that signpost. An illustration here, an example there, a particular point there. And it flowed beautifully. He had that manuscript, and when he came to that signpost, he sort of stepped aside a half step and said, "This is what happened to me and my wife the other day with respect to this situation." Well, he knew he was going to say that at that signpost. Now, what he was doing was beginning right away to progress to using notes, Brother Bob, as opposed to being totally limited to that manuscript. And I would highly recommend to you, brethren, particularly you younger brethren, starting out with manuscripts, and those of you who've been doing it for years, if you haven't already done it, perfect technique. Because you know what you're going to say, and you know why you're going to say it, and when you insert a signpost into your already existing manuscript, you fall into it so easily and so conveniently. And it flows. And before long, you'll find yourself doing that more than depending on a manuscript. Yes, Bob. Manuscript. I'm talking about a talk written out. That's a manuscript. A talk written out. I have written my exhortation word for word, which a lot of brethren do. Public lectures even. How many of you are aware of the fact that Brother Stivers had a manuscript in front of him tonight? He did. Didn't look like it, though, did it? Probably because of his experience in speaking. That's what I mean, Bob. You understand? That's a manuscript. You see what I just did? Yes, sir. Yes. When you plan on extemporaneously addressing a subject you're already aware of. Ad-libbing is fine. You will not choose your words ahead of time. What that does is add the genuineness to it. I'll be dealing with, let's see if I can quickly illustrate it. I may have a manuscript in front of me where I am hammering home the last hours that our Master spent in the Garden of Gethsemane. And I've written it out. I've got a signpost there, his prayer. Just a little note with an arrow, his prayer. I've brought us up to that point, and when I see that his prayer, brethren, see, I'm looking straight at everybody now, extemporaneously. Brethren, did we ever consider the thought process that went through our Master's mind when he looked at Peter and John and the rest of them sound asleep? What do you think about that? What kind of reception was that? No wonder he upbraided them. Can you not watch with me an hour? Now, the next time I say that, I might say it entirely different. But you get the point I'm making. You can do that very effectively, even within the confines of a manuscript. Now, reading a manuscript, Brother Harry, how do we, in fact, Brother Bob just walked in. I'm going to digress on that example I just gave you because Brother Bob, dealing with that very point, the subject matter, the prayer in the garden, and, you know, these thoughts just came together in my mind when he walked in. Some years ago, expressing in his own words, and I know that Brother Bob uses a manuscript, all right? I has many times. Excuse me for laughing, and I want you to understand that this is for illustrative purposes only. Brother Bob got so carried away with his extemporaneous comment about Jesus being upset with his followers falling asleep that he said something like this, and Bob, I'm going to paraphrase what you said. Maybe quote it. No, I'll do it. He said, "What, couldn't you even stay awake for one lousy hour?" Those people from the Baltimore meeting remember that, don't you? Well, his point was well taken. His choice of words might have left something to be desired, but that's what I mean. That illustrates exactly what I mean. You will put your own personality, your own way of expressing into that thing, even though you may be tied to a manuscript. Now, reading the manuscript. Reading the manuscript. Now, this is where practice is necessary, but it can be done. It can be done. When you are the utilizer of a manuscript and you read it aloud over and over again, practice this point. Read ahead 3 to 5 to 7 words, and you would be surprised how that translates at least into a 50% eye contact situation, Harry. Absolutely does, even in that reading I gave you just a moment ago. The scriptural terminology sometimes is far more difficult than what we'll put down in a manuscript. If we pick up a manuscript and practice it, there's no reason in the world why we cannot effectively maintain 50 to 70% eye contact and still, in a nice, smooth, properly inflected term, read from that manuscript, almost to the point that your audience will not know that you are using a manuscript. And believe me, brethren, it can be done. It can be done. In public lectures, because there are certain things that I want to make sure I say just so, I will have manuscript inserts in my notes, full paragraphs sometimes, whereas I'm using the notes the rest of the time, Bob, but I'll come to that paragraph. And I know that I want my public lecture audience to hear that in just a way. So I will go from my extemporaneous 70 to 90% eye contact, drop it down to a 50 to 70% eye contact, deal with that paragraph, and hardly any of them ever know it. Because I work on it, and you can too. You can too. I don't know what this is. I just picked it up. I had it laying here, but it has something to do with evolution. The Vanishing Case for Evolution by Henry M. Morris. In spite of these admissions, all the scientists quoted above, I just looked at that phrase, and the words, all the scientists quoted above, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words, I looked ahead and was able to say to you with eye contact, it can be done. It can be done. Get your manuscript completed, go over it, and practice getting that head up and looking at something. If you got a wife, look her in the eye. If you got a mirror, look yourself in the eye. And you would be amazed, brethren, once you set your mind to it, you'd be amazed at how effective you become with it. If you are of the mindset that I've got to read by having my head down in that proposition, if that's the way you think, that's the way you're going to do it. What you have to do is think that I can read. That doesn't mean you bob your head up and down like this. I don't mean that. You get comfortable behind a stand at such a way where it's a matter of your eyes, not your head. Yes, Pete. All right. Whatever would enable you to do it is fine, just so your audience doesn't see you're doing it. That's right. That's right. And if you want to use a ruler or a piece of plastic or your finger, you can do it. I've got my hands on this paper. No, I don't believe any of you can see my hands here. I could actually move that finger very effectively, you know, spend 50 to 70% of my time looking at you, and I know where it is. That's the point you're making. Can be done. I've trained myself that I don't have to do that. But it can be done. And it can be done unobtrusively, so nobody sees it. Perfectly all right. Perfectly all right. Again, being redundant. When you use a manuscript, purposefully begin small and enlarge the use of signposts. The more signposts you use in a structured manuscript, the more your exhortation or lecture is going to sound like nobody is reading it. In other words, if you can enlarge the signpost propositions with just a little note, Bob, just a little note, you've told yourself the subject matter that you want to treat at that stage in your dissertation. And you'll find yourself extemporaneously speaking. And that, Pete, then brings you back. You see, you know where that signpost is. That brings you right back to your manuscript without a pointer or anything of that nature. But here again, it's a matter of practice, practice, practice. Now, let's talk for a few minutes about voice, pronunciation, grammar, and gestures. Voice is something that you have absolute control over. Whether you're extemporaneously speaking, impromptu, or from a manuscript, there's absolutely no excuse for any brother, whatever the pitch of his voice, to speak in a monotone. No excuse. You can purposely lower it, and you can raise it to the heights. You've got control over that. Just remember that. And when you read or emphasize, use it. Use your voice. Use your voice. And in the proper way of using that voice, there are several things that you must always guard. We've heard it a number of times this week. How is this word pronounced? That's a G. That's get. It's not git. It's just, not gist. Many of them, Gil. Many of them. Another error that we ought to be aware of, particularly when we use manuscripts, is the use of the words I and me. I do not intend to conduct an English class tonight, but one of the greatest errors, excuse me, made by brethren on the platform is to use the word I in the objective case, and it's absolutely wrong. And when you are giving a public lecture, you are condemning that lecture in large measure if there's somebody in that audience who knows you're making a mistake. I is the word that's used in the nominative sense, not the objective sense. When we talk about the way God treats you and I, we are making a mistake. Did you hear me? God treats you and me, not you and I. Now, when we talk about you and I doing something, that's correct. Brethren, that is the most common mistake made from our platforms worldwide, or at least North American-wide. I doubt if they do it as much in England. But it's a horrible habit in North America. May I repeat that again? You never use the word I in the objective sense, and you hear it all the time. I've heard it at least 24 times thus far this week, and it's wrong. Now, that's a small thing, but it's a very important thing. Another one falling into the same classification is the use of the word a and an, A-N. Articles. But you don't use the article A when the word A-N should be used. Repeatedly done. We will not do it, any of us, if we think about it. That's why I'm bringing it to your attention as speaking or potential speaking brethren. It's a technique in public speaking we ought to be aware of. You don't make those little mistakes, because when you do make those little mistakes, it detracts in major proportions from the effectiveness of what you're saying. Another thing that happens, bless your heart, Chuck. Thank you. Another thing that happens, and it's common human common human trait. We tend to run our words together sometimes. We tend to sometimes mispronounce words by virtue of habit. Submarine for submarine. United States government for United States government. Boy and girl for boy and girl. And I'm sure each one of you can think of illustrations of what I'm trying to say. It is imperative that we open our mouths when we're speaking, that we articulate, project it.
We don't mumble into our words. We don't drop the end of the thing off.
I have heard brethren effectively deal with a phrase or a sentence, and when they get to the end, boy, do they get to the end. It's like going off the cliff. And you find yourself saying, what was that last word he said? Instead of concentrating on what he did say. You understand what I'm saying? You don't drop your voice at the end of a sentence. You don't clip off your words. You don't talk like a machine gun. You enunciate properly. You use proper grammar. You articulate in a measured way. Now, the only way you're going to do that, and I started to say you're going to do it. See, I caught myself because I'm thinking about it. The only way you're going to do it properly is to think about it, brethren. And when it's your responsibility to exhort, lecture, or preside, or teach a class, think about it in terms of your preparation. That doesn't mean that you're going to snap your fingers and become master of all that you survey overnight. But working at it will produce a very polished product. Remember the brother I mentioned in our first class who could hardly carry on an intelligible conversation, who today is a very, very good speaker? He did it by working at it. By working at it. Gestures. Gestures. We'll say a few words about gestures, and then we'll open the class to any kind of questions you want to throw at me. A gesture must be genuine. There are a number of kinds of gestures. There are forceful gestures, there are sentimental gestures, there's gestures of time and space, and they all add to effective translation to an audience. For example, Abraham lived some 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. We're somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 years since Christ was born. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's 2,000 years to 2,000 years. It's a 4,000-year period in between. Do you know I used that in Florida? I don't know whether you were there, Bob, or not. I doubt it. But I used that in Florida a few years ago, and there was a visitor there, and he came up to me after the lecture, and he says, you know, I never realized that such a time frame was involved. I know that what did it for that particular gentleman was that not practiced gesture. I practiced it tonight, of course, but not practiced gesture. It's one that came naturally in talking about that time span. When you talk about the size of something, it's huge. But when I'm sick and tired of you, I'll let you know it. And I mean, you can go on and on and on. But you don't manufacture them. They come from your intuitive emphasis. Remember that. I've got a problem, brethren, that I'm not ashamed to admit to you. Every once in a while, I'll get carried away. And we've got microphones in most of our halls. I'll get carried away, and I'll pound the lectern or the stand. And that's a mistake because it, woo! I mean, the mic shows it, the tape shows it. It's a mistake. I've even gotten to the point where I've caught myself like that. Too often I don't. It's a habit I've got to break. But it's a natural gesture on my part. If I get built up to a certain point, I'm not to pound that stand, and that's wrong. Gesture all you want to, naturally, but stay away from that mic. Okay? There are really more than one way to emphasize the message you want to transmit. And let me finish my remarks by saying this. You must remember that when you are given the responsibility of exhorting, lecturing, or teaching a class, your prime responsibility is to share with your audience, small or large, in an understandable way, ideas and information that you have spent a great deal of time working on. And anything you can do to enhance your ability to make sure that their ability is enhanced to understand, you should do it. Now, we could have gone into a great more depth in terms of some of these elements than our four sessions permitted us to do. But that's the reason the Bible School Committee asked me to conduct this voluntary class, and I'm delighted with the number who have shown the motivation to want to listen to it. But you individuals can be your best teachers if you simply think about some of the things that I've mentioned. I have to think about them. Don't always do it to the satisfaction of myself. But you start thinking about them, you're going to be a better exhorter, a better speaker, and you can pass that on to those people to whom you're addressing, trying to influence. Now let's open the floor for questions. We had a number of them last night. There may not be any tonight. Yes, Brother Bob. I just reminded them. That's what you call a flashback. Brother Stivers does it. It's almost a practiced gesture. He does it for effect, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's gotten to the point where I think that it's done with predetermined timing. And that loses its effectiveness. Nothing wrong with it. But if it's ever perceived by your audience to be manufactured, you've lost the impact. I don't know how you people have responded to that. First time or two, didn't bother me. But tonight, I got the impression it was a manufactured gesture, because he only did it one time. Yes?
At the outset, when you started talking about the use of words,
right,
you used dichotomy.
Yes.
And then you asked them how many of them.
Yes.
Knew what dichotomy meant. If in the course of a lecture you use the word dichotomy,
right,
and then you went on to explain it, which do you feel is a better approach to take? Not to use the word dichotomy, which is, you may be going over the heads of some of the audience, to go straight into what the word means and omit the word itself to convey the same impression and understanding, or to use the word dichotomy, and if anybody wants to know, they'll ask you. Now, what makes me ask you this is, some years ago, I was in a mutual improvement class, and it was quite a fruitful discussion as to whether you should, what they call, speak up to an audience, or whether you would go to the lowest level of confidence.
I'll give you my opinion on that. You must, remember what I said two nights ago, you must try to read your audience. I would have absolutely no hesitation in using the word dichotomy in certain of the audiences that I address professionally. I would be very reluctant to use it in an exhortation in a Christadelphian meeting that involved some youngsters and some elderly people who may never have been exposed to that kind of situation. So I would avoid its use. In a public lecture, you'd have to think very carefully about how you would use it. There are occasions and circumstances where the use of words like that, in irrevocable, erstwhile, and a lot of them, that might properly be used without any effort to define it. I was simply in my notes here trying to illustrate definitions. Have to be very careful. Very careful. That's why you must read your audience. And that's one of the advantages of extemporaneously speaking, speaking from notes. You can speak from notes this way or this way. You know the framework of what you want to deal with. But having read your audience, you can either express it in more juvenile terms or higher place terms, depending upon what you see. If there's a particular brother or sister in the audience that you know would have difficulty, don't do it. That person's not there, then you might do it. Those are the kind of things that you read when you speak extemporaneously. Yes, sir. Jim. Yes, I did. Visual aids. I alluded to it tonight, Jim. Visual aids are very effective, particularly in a public lecture structure. However, there's one danger. If we get to the point where the visual aids become the subject matter rather than what you have to say, we've overdone it. I would recommend that they never be used in an exhortive sense. A Sunday school class, yes, but not in an exhortation. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Comments on pronouncing of words and using of proper grammar.
Yes.
And the sounding of the endings of words. I think one of our problems is that very few of us are teachers and thereby used to using proper English and the right words all the time. Therefore, we sort of tend to speak in two languages. One language that we use commonly from day to day, talking to one another, and another language that we try to use when we give an exhortation or a lecture. And it seems to me if we tried to use the same language that we would use in giving an exhortation and a lecture all the time, all during our lives, in other words, not have two languages all, but just speak the proper English and the correct words all the time, that this would help us in our exhortation.
I couldn't disagree with that at all. In other words, learn to use the King's English and use the King's English is what you're saying. Yes.
What would you say would be the best method for a speaking brother? Say he's dealing with an emotional subject and he himself gets overly emotional. What would you say would be the best way to totally avoid something like that? Take your time, compose yourself, or...
If you find yourself in that situation, obviously you have to take your time to compose yourself. However, a brother who has the responsibility, exhortive, funerals, weddings, must, going in, have his mindset that I'm going to be faced with a situation and simply overcome it. I've conducted probably 50, 60 funerals in my lifetime. One of those 50, 60, and I remember it well, was a very emotional situation. I've married a number of couples. One of them was a very emotional situation, and I knew that that possibility existed. I barely made it through, to be honest with you. But going in, my mindset was that I have got to steel myself and not give in to it. That's part of the responsibility when you have exhortive responsibilities. You've got to have the mindset going in to deal with whatever the subject matter or the occasion calls for. It's not easy, but if you go into it blind, then you're going to knuckle under. If you go into it with a mindset that I'm not going to give in, you're better off.
Do you recommend a situation like that, even if you operate out of the notes, as a general rule, to use a manuscript in a situation like that?
Not a bad idea at all. That's what I meant, Jim, when I said I quite often will put a manuscript paragraph when I'm giving a public lecture or a funeral, and certainly a wedding. Although there are a number of extemporaneous comments in the process of those things. But that's where you've got to structure it a little bit differently, and that tends to help deal with the points you've raised. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
In reading scriptural references such as concerning the emblems and the reading itself, do you recommend looking up 50% of the time or more to the audience, even though they may be having their heads down reading the same scripture?
No. Very good point. When a brother is doing the reading, let's say the daily reading in the morning or the reading that the exhorting brother has asked, it is not necessary for the reader to concentrate on the eye contact proposition, because 95 out of 100 people are going to have their eyes on their Bibles. In that situation, the answer is no. I'm talking about when you have that audience watching you. Big difference. Yes, Bob.
Wouldn't that also be very good practice?
It would be. Would be good practice. I'm not arguing about the practice. I read his question to mean, should you worry about eye contact in that situation? Good practice, yes, but not necessary because they're not looking at you. In fact, I have seen situations where the reading brother is totally unknown to the people. Totally unknown. He gets up and reads and sits down, and they don't know who he was because they have looked it up, they've been looking it up, and they follow it.
What is your thought on using the besides the King James Version in a meeting, as far as, I know in reading we use the King James, but others use other versions, with, and sometimes you lose some of the meaning.
Yes, you do. I have gotten, Brother Harry, and this is personal opinion, I've gotten to the point where I use my RSV most of the time. I will use it even in exhortive situations. But when I do, I let my audience know that I'm using the RSV, and when I read a citation from the RSV and I happen to know what the King James word or phrase is, I'll say, now in your own Bible it'll be this and this way or that way. I try to cover it by that bridge, but I've gotten to the point where I use the RSV because I prefer it. However, recognizing that the King James is the common, and I've got a King James, obviously, I will allude to that King James invariably. Yes, Edie. Well, you're talking about a practical ecclesial question. It has little or nothing to do with public speaking techniques, but I'll give you my opinion. I'll do it not on this tape. I think they should be uncovered, but in my own ecclesia, they're not. They are uncovered when the memorial service itself is underway, but not during the exhortation. I like it, frankly, to have them uncovered before the exhortation. But that's just my personal opinion. We're getting close to the bewitching hour. I'll take one or two more questions. Yes, Bob.
Your opinion, please, on the use of numbers. Like I've heard, particularly in lectures, brother would have a magazine and he'll quote the date on it, and then he'll say that there were so many thousands of this stuff. People won't remember those numbers, and I find it to be, you know, almost totally useless to listen to the numbers he gives, and has really nothing to do with the subject. And you lose it.
If it has nothing to do with the subject, he shouldn't use it. If the
number is trying to emphasize the point by using numbers, because people will forget the numbers. And myself, I find it, I feel they should not be used.
Well, Bob, it depends. It may be that a brother, particularly in a lecture situation, is trying to draw a mental picture of the size of something. It's unimportant, almost irrelevant, that the numbers be remembered if, in fact, the point of the size has been identified in the minds of the hearer. Depends. I'd have to look at the specific situation to give you an honest reaction. I can see where numbers would be used to identify the magnitude of something, but no intention that they be remembered. I wouldn't hesitate to use it for that purpose. Anything else? If not, all right, one more. Yes, always say where it's coming from. However, the question came up the other night, do we ask our audience to turn it up? And if you recall, I said, no, you don't, particularly in the exhortation situation. A brother or sister is going to turn that reference up by your identifying it. If it's a specific instance where you want to make sure a skeptic or a cynic in a lecture knows that you are saying exactly what that record says, then you might invite them to turn it up. Here again, it's a matter of reading your audience. reading your audience, but you should always identify where your citation is coming from. Always. Absolutely. Yes, Malcolm.
Not to belabor that point, but if I was to say Luke 21 and then prepare to read that, 90% of those listening would be thumbing through to find that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better to give the verses and then say what it was at the end? Let's say it was Luke 21, verse 10 or whatever.
There are circumstances where that would be quite acceptable, Malcolm, if it's a matter of not wanting everybody to leaf through, particularly in the public lecture situation. In the exhortive situation, I wouldn't recommend that. I would recommend that just a slight pause. I mean a slight pause. I don't mean something 5 and 10 seconds long. When you've given a citation, just a slight pause, because most of the members are just as adept at turning those things up as we are. Which brings me to a point I didn't make that I must make. I'm sorry, I overlooked it. And it's a simple technique, brethren. It's very important. When you've got your Bible, now, if you're familiar enough with it that you turn your references up without any markers, which most of us eventually get to, that's fine. But if you have a half a dozen or more references that you're going to turn up, where do you put your markers?
On the bottom.
Absolutely on the bottom. Never on the top where they are seen. You never do this. You always do this. And a little technique, particularly for beginning brethren, is write the citation right on it. James 1:5. And you've got it sticking there. See, you've got your Bible open. Nobody's noticed. Well, brethren, I'm going to refer to the first chapter of James, verse 5. Well, you know people are going to start turning it up. But you reach down, you've got James 1:5, and there you are. Never at the top. Never put it in. I'm sorry, Malcolm, but you sort of pushed my button on that one. I'm glad you did. Yes, Bob.
In connection with that, Bill, I've seen the young brother at our meeting. He has little tabs in like that. And it's very distracting that he takes them out, crinkles it up,
Bob,
and puts it in his pocket.
Bob, amen. Absolutely. He's destroyed the whole proposition. Take them out and drop them on the floor if you have to, but don't take them out and crumple them up and put them in your pocket. Oh, no.
When you make a quotation, it's from one of those little books that's kind of hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
Write the page number by the quote.
That's fine. That's fine. Absolutely. Anything that will help you unobtrusively turn it up.
Yep.
Yes, Gil?
I sometimes do it. I've had done it. Mine is type the reference right in red or a different color, just so you're coming to it, and it makes it that much easier. You're going to have to be careful and allow time for people.
What that does is make you feel comfortable in terms of the way you transit into that, and that's fine. Anything that makes you comfortable. The whole principle from the speaking end is to do nothing, if you can avoid it, that's going to interfere with the reception on a smooth basis by your hearers. Anything that's going to distract them, stay away from it. Stay away from it. Well, I think the tape's run out. I've got to go back to Washington tonight, so we'll just cut it off now, and God willing, we'll work on all of this together. Thank you very much for your attendance.